figures are on a national scale, and not specifically in Tehran province. Dr. Khosrow Shahi, may God rest his soul, built 428 schools. And we weren't even allowed to name him. He asked us to wait until after his death to mention his name.
Our MP of the day is a Ms. Qasemipur. She is MP for Kurdistan, Sanandaj.
Speaking of the scarcity of lands, I need to explain that the Ministry of Education has some lands. Either some honorable people dedicate their lands in our beloved country and give it to the ministry, or the municipalities set them off with the ministry. The lands are given to benefactors. Because the charity members have run into problems in the past, they insist that the lands must be in the name of the education ministry. Otherwise, they won't do any construction on the lands.
Education for all has also meant for the children of illegal immigrants, that is by the leader's decree of May 2015. Currently, some 110,000 illegal Afghan national students are studying in Iran. A total 88% of the refugees' children are studying in Iranian schools, and by next school year, beginning September the 23rd, that rate should increase to 90% in elementary schools. The Ministry of Education has allocated 10 trillion riyals, nearly $240 million, for refugees' education. This is while international donations constitute only 2 to 2.5% of the amount. A gap this great has left the ministry facing major problems.
We have a good position in the field of construction. In 2017, our country won the Sasakawa International Award for the Safety of Educational Spaces. Sasakawa is an international award given to only two countries every year, and it was the first time that this award was given to the Iranian ambassador in Mexico. Iran won first place in strengthening educational spaces.
Each year, students in Iran start school on September the 23rd, after the three-month summer holiday. But with the coronavirus pandemic at large this year, all educational centers in the country have been closed since late February 2020. And education has been conducted in three forms: in-person, virtual, and television-based. Haven't heard anything on support for education or school building today, but it is naturally on the general agenda of Parliament, which is why we're here to hear it from an MP.
I have concentrated on this issue since I've been a member because I am an educator myself. I've had a meeting with the esteemed head of the renovation organization. He agreed to a special condition for me after I explained the situation in the region. The government usually engages with the benefactors in building schools and pays 50% of the costs. But the head of the renovation organization agreed to a 70-30 scenario, meaning the government would be responsible for 70% and the donors 30%. That's because the students are in a very bad situation there. Based on per capita educational space and standards that exist in the country, I think there's half a meter of space for every student there.
The national budget bill for the next Iranian calendar year of March 2021 to 22 has foreseen a 21% rise for the renovation and retrofitting of schools. Over the past 4 years, the number of old classrooms in need of reconstruction and retrofitting has been reduced from 30% to 19.5%. Capital city Tehran has the highest number of old schools, but donors tend to donate in their own local hometowns or to deprived areas. There are some 107,000 schools nationwide with 530,000 classes, 160,000 of which are dilapidated and dangerous. That means 30% of the schools nationwide don't meet safety standards.
We give priority to esteemed benefactors who work hard to build schools in deprived regions. Because our main objective is educational equality and justice, students in deprived regions also have the right to use the same educational facilities and schools available elsewhere in our beloved Iran, so we need to start from there. The donors themselves want to spend their money somewhere that those who are really in need can benefit. Kurdistan province is one of those places, especially where my constituency is at. Because it's an immigrant-friendly city, there are 44,000 students there. The government doesn't have enough facilities to dedicate to the students. So we need to seek help from charity members.
If you examine the region itself, Tehran has more students compared to other cities. It's true that some rural areas lack schools altogether, but Tehran has a lower per capita space for every student. That's why Tehran needs much more schools than elsewhere.
Goes without say, with school building this high up on Iran's cultural agenda, in natural disaster, people waste no time in turning their eyes to the situation children find themselves in. And benefactors donated $48 million to rebuild flood-hit schools in 2018-19. The devastating floods hit 28 of Iran's 31 provinces, leaving some 1,500 schools damaged, 200 of which were razed to the ground. In the year from March 2018 to 2019, more than half of school classes were built by benefactors, and within a 10-year period, the number of dilapidated schools dropped from two-thirds to one-third.
One of the characteristics of the Iranian nation is our love for knowledge and culture. This isn't a simple claim. History has clearly shown that. For example, the development of educational spaces in our country dates back to at least 1,000 years ago. If we specifically consider schools and special spaces where education takes place, you can look at Rab al-Rashidi 800 years ago. Why is Rab al-Rashidi so famous? Rab al-Rashidi was a complex comprising four sections, and according to available data, it housed 5,000 students from around the world 800 years ago. Iranians have always been pioneers in the field of science and knowledge. Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir built Darul Funun 160 years ago. That's another educational space built by a benevolent man.
More yet to come of our narration, but let's hear a word from others and taking a look at other media outlets in the meantime. And here's what other media outlets have to say. IGNA quotes the leader. Education system should pursue formation of religious, just, ideal society, says Ayatollah Khamenei. The Islamic government was established on the basis of this goal. The formation of a religious, just, ideal society. Naturally, the education system of the country cannot pursue a goal in opposition to the overall goal pursued by the whole system. He said this on the occasion of National Teachers' Day. The leader outlined, children, the youth, and young adults in our Islamic society learn that they should develop and utilize their talents and their potential capabilities on the path of achieving lofty national values, Islamic and revolutionary values. Islam invites us to acquire beneficial knowledge. On the one hand, beneficial knowledge equips young Iranians with the necessary tools for the progress and growth of their country and people. And on the other hand, it gives them identity and enriches them with dignity, psychological and spiritual esteem and self-confidence. We have a word from Tehran Times. If anything ever deserved high representation, school building ambassadors coming to aid education system. In line with the document of the fundamental transformation of education, people who have a popular reputation are being invited as ambassadors to attract public participation for school construction. The director of the Organization for Renovation, Development and Equipment of Schools said this. School building ambassadors have been selected in four provinces of the country so far, and we are going to have one school ambassador from each province, IGNA quoted Mehrollah Rakhshani Mehras saying. It has always been thought that only a certain number of people can afford to build a school, but all people can participate, even by buying a brick, he highlighted. He further explained that a system is set up in which under-construction projects are introduced, and users can select each project and pay as much as they can to build a school. Not to forget the importance of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund in Education, Tehran Times says, Education Ministry UNICEF Inc. MOU to enhance co-op. The Ministry of Education and United Nations Children's Fund have signed a Memorandum of Understanding to expand cooperation in 2021. Iran's Deputy Education Minister for International Affairs, Ghulam Reza Karimi, and UNICEF representative in Tehran, Mandeep O'Brien, discussed further cooperation in a meeting in Tehran. During the meeting, Karimi expressed readiness to cooperate with UNICEF to improve the quality of education in compliance with Iran's Islamic approaches. He discussed the activities of the Ministry of Education in combating the pandemic and school reopening and asked UNICEF to provide the ministry with the best global experiences in the field of education. The UNICEF representative praised Iran's efforts in education coverage, especially 99% student enrollment and the elimination of inequality in the education of girls and boys, and announced readiness to cooperate with Iran in intercultural education for refugees and to provide successful global experiences in education. That would be it for the news section. Some 2,500 public schools are operational in Tehran, and every year, 10 of them are added to a long list of dilapidated ones, while only 3 to 4 new schools are established annually. Since 2006, some 50% of the schools nationwide have been reconstructed, and the rest are waiting for budget allocation to be renovated. Tehran has been estimated to need roughly $250 million to rebuild ramshackle schools and another $110 million to make them earthquake resistant. Education means so much to Iranian society that even people with professions far from anything academic have involved themselves in school building. Mostly people with no other academic involvement, actually. Looking at the different uses some of the educational donations have been put into and what it has produced is touching. I was told by donors that the late Imam Khomeini himself gave 500 million riyals at time of war, which was divided between schools.
If you make an assessment, the culture of education and research has been growing since the Islamic Revolution. That is, for example, our students who win awards in the field of nanotechnology are mostly educated in less advantaged areas of the cities. We are now the world's sixth leading country in the field of nanotechnology. This shows that if the educational spaces are prepared for the use of our dear students, they enthusiastically use them to realize their great mission to achieve their higher cultural and educational goals.
But even with 110,000 schools and 550,000 classrooms in the country, roughly speaking, challenges remain. The country has 14 million school kids with 5 square meters of school space per kid. Classrooms of 32 students on average need to be reduced to 24 students. If you plan to become a donor, you should know donors can supervise school management.
If someone wants to join the School Builder Charity Association, they can contact the association or the renovation organization by doing a simple internet search. They provide their primary information, including how much they're willing to spend and what they want to do. They can either come to Iran themselves or choose a relative, friend, or an acquaintance to take care of the work as their representative. It's interesting to know that the latter method has become more frequently used recently. It wasn't as easy in the past. Now, the benefactors know people who are well aware of the regulation and know what to do and how to build the schools.
The Charity Schools Association of Iran is the best place to raise this money. Most donors, for example, want to write a check in our name, but we do not accept it and tell them to deposit it in the account of the assembly. Even if the donors pay money to the renovation organization, the body transfers the sums to the association. The association has a lot of money and is decisive. The association sometimes completes semi-finished school projects because people have more trust in it than the other organizations.
Going by 2018 information, while in the 1970s the enrollment rate of the boys and girls in primary education was 70%, this currently exceeds 98%. There are elementary schools in almost all areas across the country, and in some regions there are elementary schools with just one student.
We have 3 historical periods in school construction in Iran. One was Darul Funun, another period goes back to the time of Rushdie and Bakhchaban, who found the schools for deaf students. The third one is the modern era. We are now looking to construct schools that would meet all educational needs of students while being a safe and comfortable environment that can fully withstand natural disasters.
Well, Iran has long had a strong educational base to build on, and it has done so. talking of children in schools, it's not to say there are no out-of-school children, but numbers of out-of-school kids in primary school age have dwindled. It is noteworthy enrollment of boys and girls in primary education is almost equal in Iran.
Our noble benefactors work really hard and make sacrifices. This is because they realize that a transcendent society needs an educational environment that promotes culture. We are thankful to God that now Iran is rich in culture. Members from UNESCO visited Iran at the invitation of the renovation organization. We took them for a tour of the schools built by donors. It was totally unbelievable for them. They said, how is it possible for a person to donate such astronomical amounts to build a school? When we told them that someone holds a record of building 428 schools, they couldn't believe it. Most of the members told us you should win the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Wishing you all the best for the new year, I bid you farewell.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of our weekly series, Path Towards Enlightenment, a program in which we try to give you an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left off last week, and here are ayahs 7, 8 and 9 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O you who have faith, if you help Allah, He will help you and make your feet steady. As for the faithless, their lot will be to fall into ruin, and He will make their works go awry. That is because they loathe what Allah has sent down, so He made their works fall. If you might recall last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the seemingly good deeds of the disbelievers, though these may be of benefit for the doers in their brief transient life of the mortal world, these deeds have no worth and value in afterlife, since these were not based on faith. We also said that when the disbelievers impose wars, the believers ought to decisively confront them, but according to Islamic rules, should spare the life of those who surrender, as well as of the civilians. As for the martyrs, their sins are forgiven for their sacrifice in defending the faith, and they are alive with provisions from the Lord Most High, while we cannot perceive them. The ayahs that we just recited to you now mean to say that the faithful should be patient and steadfast in defending religion and preventing corruption through whatever means they're capable of, such as speech, writing, property, and even life, all of which are considered striving in the way of Allah. who will keep our feet firm and steady on the right path for having helped him, although he is far too glorious to need any help. As for the material power of the disbelievers and the massive efforts they make against Islam, these are not lasting and will sooner or later bring ruin upon them because of their disobedience of God's commandments and refusal to believe in what He has sent for the guidance of mankind. Hence, the ultimate loss for them. From these ayahs, we learn that 1. Faith ought to be accompanied by deeds in order to promote truth and prevent corruption and deviation, since God helps the believers in their endeavors for having defended religion. And 2. The believers have various means to defend religion, ranging from speech and writing to property and even life, in order to defeat the stratagems of the enemies. And 3. Those who oppose divine commandments and deny the manifest truth will eventually suffer ruin and loss. Now let us listen to ayahs 10 and 11 of the same surah. Have they not travelled over the land so that they may observe how the fate of those who were before them was? Allah destroyed them, and a similar fate awaits the faithless. That is because Allah is the protector of the faithful, and because the faithless have no protector. Here the Almighty tells people that while traveling around different lands, they should keenly observe the ruins that dot the earth and ponder on the fate of the once mighty civilizations of the past that were destroyed for disobeying divine commandments, denying the missions of the prophets, persecuting them, oppressing the populace, and indulging in sins. It means a similar terrible fate awaits the present-day arrogant and unjust regimes for their spread of corruption on earth and efforts to suppress the believers, little knowing that God Almighty is the protector of the upright ones, while the disbelievers have no protector. These ayahs teach us the following. 1. There are lessons to be learned while we travel around various lands and observe the relics of the past, which far from being the remains of a supposedly mighty civilization, are in fact an eye-opener for us to desist from disobedience of God in order to avoid a similar destruction. And 2, God is the protector of the believers for their faith and sincere efforts, while the disbelievers bring ruin upon themselves by rejecting the manifest truth. And 3, it is faith in God Almighty that ensures the real success and prosperity, whether in the transient life of this world or in the permanence of afterlife, while there is nothing but perpetual loss for the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners. Now let us listen to Ayah 12 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, from the Holy Quran. Indeed, Allah will admit those who have faith and do righteous deeds into gardens with streams running in them. As for the faithless, they enjoy and eat just like the cattle eat, and the fire will be their final abode. In this ayah, God Almighty gives tidings to the believers, whose faith is coupled with good deeds, of the bliss of gardens of paradise, where they will enjoy the shade of verdant trees and the delightful sights of fresh flowing streams, amid all kinds of comfort and luxuries as a reward for their abstinence from sins. In its next part, the ayah warns the disbelievers of the terrible fate awaiting them in the fires of hell for their denial of the manifest truth and indulgence in sins, since they preoccupied themselves with the pleasures of the flesh and ate anything, whether good or bad, whether permissible or prohibited, just as the cattle and other animals do, without taking any steps towards self-reform and repentance, or for that matter, thinking about spiritual values. This ayah teaches us that 1. The believers are rewarded with the bliss of paradise as recompense for their faith, virtuous life, abstinence from sins, and struggle against the arrogant. 2. Pleasures of the world are transient and a distraction from realities, so one should think of the hereafter, resurrection, and the day of judgment, instead of wasting life in the pursuit of vain desires. And 3. Islam permits enjoyment of life, but in an orderly and virtuous manner, and strictly forbids a life of animal freedom spent in pursuit of carnal pleasures. And 4. To choose the right way of living, we should keep sight of the final abode, which should not be the fire of hell, which is the result of our own misdeeds. Now let us listen to ayahs 13 and 14 of Surah Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny from the Holy Quran, as the concluding ayahs of this week's episode. How many a town here has been which was more powerful than your town which expelled you, which we have destroyed, and they had no helper? Is he who stands on a manifest proof from his Lord like someone to whom the evil of his conduct is made to seem decorous, and who follow their desires? The intransigent disbelievers are always boastful of their wealth and what they call their welfare and guarantee for a powerful future, without reflecting on the fate of the past nations that the Almighty destroyed for their arrogance and sins. This ayah, which was a warning to the pagan Arabs of Mecca, who thought themselves as powerful and forced the Prophet of Islam to migrate to Medina, serves as a lesson for all generations. Just like the terrible fate of the strong and powerful Arab nations of the past, that is, the Ard and the Thamud, who were struck by divine wrath for their disobedience, neither the disbelievers of Mecca succeeded against the Prophet of Islam, nor will any future enemies of Islam succeed against righteous Muslims. God is the protector of the believers, whilst there is no one to protect the disbelievers, whose evil is beautified by the ever-deceiving Satan. Thus the virtuous, who are indeed a manifest proof from their Lord, can never be considered equal to the vicious following evil desires. From these ayahs we learn the following points. 1. The faithful should not fear the apparent power of the enemies, who are actually weak, since there is no greater power than that of the Almighty. 2. The believers should stand firm against the various stratagems of the disbelievers, and should continue their struggle against the enemies. 3. The base of faith is argumentation and clear proof, while disbelief stands precarious on slippery turf in view of its false ideas and pursuit of carnal desires. And 4. Satan beautifies to the disbelievers their evil deeds and makes them more intransigent against faith and Islamic values.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. U.S. President Joe Biden has addressed Americans after a surge in attacks against Asians inside of the United States. Now, he said that the U.S. is no place for hate. And that sounds like a great slogan, but if we look at the historic reality, it seems that hatred has been a consistent fiber of life for many minorities in the country.
The United States has witnessed yet another hate crime against minority groups that sparked a nationwide debate over the threats these people are facing in the country. On Wednesday, a white man gunned down 8 people, including 6 Asian women at spas around Atlanta. The incident raised fears that it might be a new wave of attacks on Asian Americans. A report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists pose the most lethal domestic terrorism threats to the U.S. It also warned that threats from domestic violent extremism are metastasizing across the country and could grow in 2021. Hate crimes against minorities in the U.S. have significantly increased over the past years, as former President Donald Trump explicitly favored white people over people of color. Many African Americans and Hispanics have been attacked or killed by white police officers or extremist groups. Asian Americans are in no better condition. They have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak, as Trump directly blamed China for the pandemic. Now the question is, how would a country whose foundation has been built on killing the minorities manage to get rid of racism, which has been entrenched in its culture for centuries?
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of Washington, D.C., Senior Member, Black Alliance for Peace, NEDPA, Fremont, and professor at Pune and political commentator Danny Shum out of New York. Welcome, both of you, to the program. Let's start this off in D.C. with NEDFA. What do you think is actually behind the spike in attacks that we're witnessing right now against Asians?
Well, I think most people understand that it started with a lot of the rhetoric that Donald Trump was having, and people in that of that ilk in terms of the United States at low level of xenophobic, more the low level of political understanding and analysis, but highly xenophobic dispositions and mentality, and trying to blame, and the U.S. not really taking responsibility, for its role and the spread and proliferation of the pandemic here. And then, you know, Trump making his comments, and then people and other people, not just Trump, but other people, Kung Flu and all those kind of crazy things. But at the same time, we should not make this only about Trump, because I think here the Democrats, the Democratic Party, particularly this new administration, would love to scapegoat Trump and his role in that Trump administration and the rise of xenophobic and right-wing racist phenomenon, or not really a rise in it. It's not really more prominent than it was before, but maybe it's gotten more desperate. But we also shouldn't divorce it from the foreign policy and the angling of the United States, which is very racist foreign policy disposition toward China and Korea, and angling for war, and that in itself comes with its own propaganda. Washington, the Wall Street Journal, and all of them participate in this angling. So when people have low levels of political understanding and they don't understand colonialism and how the global economy works and things like that, then they will often see as their adversaries people that are not like them, and the people who are in the eye in this kind of focus, this lens of attack. And so that's where I would start with that, is that, it's generally the United States capitalist, settler, colonialist system and imperialist government that kind of sets this tone and is an incubator mm-hmm. for such backwards ideas.
Okay. Well, Danny, touching on some of the same points that NEDFA has made, though, I want your perspective on how much of what we are witnessing do you think relates to what we saw take place during the Trump administration. As NEDFA said, it was as far as the jargon that was used and the whole atmosphere, is it more that, or in general, that this country basically was built on racism, and there is a great racial divide that is taking place in the U.S. now?
In the words of Malcolm X, you can't have capitalism without racism. And we are fed a steady diet of xenophobic, anti-immigrant, xenophobic miseducation in this country. Unfortunately, these horrific killings in Atlanta do not come as a surprise in a country where, in the words of H. Rap Brown, racism is American as apple pie. After January 6th, with the countdown to inauguration, we were just counting how many incidents, how many high-profile incidents of anti-Asian violence would there be. And as NEDFA has laid out in his summation, there's this long history of anti-China, anti-socialist propaganda. We only have to check the front page every day of the Financial Times in London, in the New York Times here, and across this country. So it's not just coming from the right wing. It's coming from both wings of the ruling class. As the competition with China heats up, this is a technological and economic and diplomatic battle. So these headlines, unfortunately, are going to continue to play out, especially among the white working class, who's been fed how many centuries of white supremacy and backwardness.
Well, Nick, but what do you make of Biden's comments that the U.S. is not a country of hate? Because if we look at the U.S.'s terrible record when it comes to dealing, especially with Native and Black Americans, it's deeply rooted in hate. But your overall take on the way this administration has been addressing this issue, do you see it as being hypocritical?
Well, it's absolutely hypocritical, and what it comes at a time where actually this this wing of the ruling class, which is dominated by the Democratic Party and this Biden-Harris presidency, is really doing its best to, aside, this issue emerges when it's doing its best to play on a crude identity politics that's absent of the class struggles, that's absent of capitalism, and trying to play on, well, Black Lives Matter and other people matter, and that movement that's making them have to address what's being called racial injustice or racial justice has emerged, particularly young people who have a very internationalist purview, who are open to other peoples, and they're trying to but they want that to stay there, and they don't want like what we just what we talked about here earlier with Danny mentioning, is that the United States and its capitalism is intertwined with racism, and they can't be separated. They need to separate it, and so that's what they're doing. So he has to give pronouncements denouncing what's happening. They want to make sure we don't make the connections of those things with the foreign policy toward like North Korea and China and other places around the world. It's absolutely hypocritical. Not to mention, even if we're talking about police, they have to embrace police in spite of the fact that the overwhelming sentiment against the racial justice against the police and how racist they are as an institution. And so, you know, it's nothing but hypocrisy when he can't tease out all the rest of the interconnections and intersections of this issue.
Well, Danny, in 2020, we saw many people protest against racial inequality. What came about of those demonstrations? Has anything changed?
That's a great question. A lot of window dressing, especially from the Democrats, but institutionally, systematically, what has changed? Segregation and white supremacy and police brutality has not changed. A year ago, when Breonna Taylor was murdered, we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the brutal torture and assassination of George Floyd. But the people continue to resist, proving how true the statement is that repression breeds resistance, and only resistance can bring us our freedom. Today, across the country, as we speak, there are demonstrations against racism, against anti-Asian hatred and hate crimes. So really, it's only the people in motion with these different anti-racist and anti-imperialist organizations who can usher in a new day. It's not going to be a Joe Biden or a Kamala Harris or any other white knight from their pedestal that's going to cause any real systematic change. So I think it's correct to be in the streets, to stand with our Asian sisters and brothers across this country at this crucial moment, at this tragic historical moment.
Listen to what Danny just said. Let's talk about that possibility, talking about a rising resistance. When we look at, because you pointed out and talked about the way the U.S. is handling its foreign policy and the way it has demonized, for example, China or North Korea, and of course the way the mainstream media, also promotes what the state is basically telling them. So how likely is it that we will get to that point of this rising resistance, this, woke group that really can make that change that's necessary?
It's interesting that you use the term woke, because the Wall Street Journal rather just had put out a thing using the term sort of more disparagingly. Mm-hmm. Is it the way of disparaging the xenophobia and racism and whatnot? But I think one of the things, and this is where the media is very key to the answering into your question, is that it is quite likely. One of the things, in spite of all of the megaphone, you know, they're using to put out their propaganda and their spin, is that they're not reporting on, for example, Dan mentioned a lot of the demonstrations that are going on. If we go into those demonstrations, particularly if you look at people's journalism and people's coverage, so to speak, that the internet has on social media and whatnot, we can see a lot of solidarity with these young people across race lines, race lines, if you will, but also recognizing the solutions that Danny talked about, that it's not within the state, and then denouncing the police. I saw one a young woman, Asian woman, who was talking about having a discussion with her mother about the role of police, and them thinking, well, the hate crimes that are emerging against Asians in the United States means that we have to embrace the police. And she was explaining to her mother, no, the police don't keep us safe. And then she talked about the racist policies and actions and implementation of police against African people, black people in this country. And so, and you know, just if you look, if you're on the ground among the people, you can see that there's an emerging young generation that sees through this stuff. We just don't get, it doesn't get reported. As long as we're also using mobilizations to engage in organization with political education, then it's inevitable. This system is crumbling, and the contradiction of the system cannot be hidden. I mean, they can do a good job of making it look like it's hidden, but it's not really hidden from the people who have to face the consequences of it.
Well, Danny, in a report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, it says the biggest threat to the United States is racially motivated domestic terrorism. Your take on this assessment?
Yeah, no question. I mean, even the FBI in the state has recognized this, yet here we have this assassin, this racist murderer, who killed 8 people, and the police apprehend him peacefully. He doesn't have a scratch on him. So we see, whether it's Dylan Roof or this other young man, these are deeply sick individuals, infected with how many decades and centuries of the white supremacy, and then the police handle them with kids' gloves. I think it's important to continue to take these big steps back and contextualize internationally how fearful this decaying empire is of China, of China's $1 trillion investment in other countries across Latin America, the new accords with Australia, with Japan, with other Asian powers. We remember Obama's pivot to Asia, so quote-unquote away from the war on terrorism. So it's within this context that we see these attacks on China, as if China were somehow our existential threat here in New York City and D.C. and beyond, when it's probably the coronavirus, lack of health care. But you cannot have war without racist demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. So that's the context that really puts whether somebody is Southeast Asian or Vietnamese or Filipino, they fall into this category of a people who's being branded as this internal enemy. So if we don't have that context, then we're going to believe the MSNBC and CNN headlines that these are just individual racist attacks, when in fact it's part of something much bigger.
What about that, NETFA, what Danny just said about that demonization? And he was talking, of course, on an international level, but even locally. I mean, if we look at what's happening inside the states, there are some analysts who talks about that this technique that is being used is the divide and conquer, divide the people, divide them into races, divide them into whatever you can divide them into, in order that they cannot unite and actually really make a change in the system. What do you think about that side of things?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's absolutely true. You can't have it without having even domestic, propaganda to confuse people. In fact, I alluded a couple times to this Washington Wall Street Journal article that talked about what it was doing was demonizing language and woke, saying, accusing China and a media thing of using woke language, as it said, to confuse, create racial tensions in the United States and animosity, as if there's not racism here already. And then way of saying that social justice movements are being influenced by outside agitators is that whole trope that's longstanding in the United States. Just like they did with they did the same thing with Russia, and saying these little insignificant social media posts were aggravating tensions in the United States, as opposed to the actual real root problem itself being the cause of the unrest here. And so what is that? That's to divide us, to create some attempt, and I will say it's a feeble attempt. I don't think it will work, but a feeble attempt to accuse those of us who are on the ground talking about racial justice of being influenced by something else and not having the intelligence to know the difference between what really ails us and afflicts us, as opposed to these other messages, so-called messages that are supposed to be coming from somewhere else.
Well, Danny, your take. How do you see the future in the United States? Because you talked about these growing movements and these demonstrations and more young people having more of an international perspective. Do you see the future, basically, the pendulum swinging as far as the amount of people who are aware and being able to make a change in that system? Or do you see the system just crumbling, basically, because it won't make the changes that these young people and others are demanding?
Yeah, a study showed that 43% of young people in the U.S. look favorably upon socialism. I think there's more and more international solidarity every day with different struggles in the global south, whether it's in Haiti or in Nicaragua and Cuba and Venezuela. One-third to one-fourth of humanity lives under the suffocating sanctions of the empire. So it is upon us for the pendulum to swing. It won't be delivered by UPS or from on high, from without. It is incumbent upon us to organize this movement through popular education, to oppose it every moment, ruling class ideology, all of the ugliness and backwardness and white supremacy that seeps through this miseducational system, this mainstream corporate media. So there's a lot of work in front of us, and how important for everyone out there to join an organization, join study groups, and to be a part of this history, because all of humanity and the future of the planet depends upon it.
Ned, for your take, what do you think it's going to take to bring about the necessary change in that country?
You mean in the U.S.?
Yes.
I agree with exactly what Danny said, and I think it's that the most impacted, the most people that facing the most disparaging impacts of this system, unjust capitalist racist system, need to be organized, and the particularly working class people of non-white working class need to be at the lead of that struggle, making unity with the broader working class in the United States. And then we also, I'll just say this, is we also have to, they're doing their best in the previous example that we mentioned, doing their best to disparage other forms of media information, and because they're not, it's a desperate attempt, because they know people are realizing they can't depend on these corporate forms of information, so they want to disparage other folks. So, you know, like we mentioned, the Wall Street Journal's attempt. So we have to be able to look at other outlets like this one, like the media outlet right here. None of these corporate things will have Danny or I on here or anybody else talking about this topic the way we're talking about it. And so we have to look at other forms of information. And like Danny said, we also have to engage in collective popular education, political education, not just consuming the information, but getting together so we can have an interpretation of the information that we're getting to inform our organizing.
Thank you both for being with us on this debate. Senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netfa Freeman out of Washington, D.C., and Professor Ed Cooney and political commentator Danny Shaw, New York. And as always, we're